This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, halflings! It's me, Jasper William Cartwright, and I am joined today by...
Jeremy Cobb. My pronouns are he, him, but Tyler F. calls me Ichacob Crane, the headless GM.
Ichacob Crane, the headless GM.
It's a quality one.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's top shelf stuff. Jesus. That's really, really good. That's setting the bar pretty high.
Yeah.
For
that it knocked my head off.
Yeah, it literally it took your
so
head
low,
clean
I guess.
Off.
Yeah, so high that I, yeah. Whatever happened, my head's gone now.
Whatever happens, it's gone. It's completely gone. Well, we are very excited today to welcome our next guest to the Three Black Halflings stage, the stadium of halflings, and an incredible guest who we've been, especially you, Jeremy, have been telling us we needed to be having on for so, so long. So please, everyone welcome the creator of Coyote and Crow Gaming, Connor Alexander. Welcome to the show!
Oh my god!
The wrong dungeon and the wrong dragon.
Full prince vibe? Woof.
This makes them even more black.
Cake glitches and pitches.
And lands in the cusp of a teaspoon.
Oh, no.
On a nat 20.
No!
You think this is just a game?
That's disgusting and I love it.
Yeah. We're about to get into something real big now.
Thanks so much for having me. Thank you so much. Woo! Appreciate it. Yeah, it's great to be on the show.
Thank you so much for coming.
We are so, excited to
have
you.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you. Absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you.
I think one of my favorite things, this is just where I wanted to start, if I may, is on the original, your original Kickstarter, which obviously did phenomenally well, mm-hmm. Which 2021, if I'm not mistaken,
yeah.
Is that about right?
It's yeah, kind of 2021. It's been a while already, March of 2021. Yeah.
I feel that. I definitely feel that. It feels like a lifetime since
yes.
then, right? But the opening line of the Kickstarter is a science fiction and fantasy tabletop RPGs set in the near future where Americas were never colonized. We love this on Three Black Gold. This is great.
Yeah.
And like that, I saw that and was like, yep, I'm going to love this. This is great. So I guess we'll start to talk. We'll get to know you a little bit before we find out about this amazing thing that you have created. So Connor Alexander, please tell the halflings, a little bit about your nerdy origin story. How did you get into all of this kind of game design and tabletop role-playing games? And what made you fall in love with
it? So I'm an only child, and I grew up with a lot of extended family around me, my uncles especially, who were fairly close in age. The nearest one was only like 4 or 5 years older than me. And he had he was very into board games. He was sort of a proto nerd. This is early 70s at this point. And he really got me into like traditional board gaming at that point. I was playing a lot of like chess and Battleship and all the things that little kids play, right? He also really got me involved in science fiction and fantasy. He was the one that introduced me to Star Trek and Mission Impossible and the Twilight Zone. And I think growing up as a kid without siblings and also as a kid who moved around a lot with a single mom, I was always having to find ways to entertain myself and engage my own imagination to get me through some of those afternoons. And around the sixth, I think it was the sixth grade now, I'm really a little foggy this far back, but one of the other kids at my school introduced me to Dungeons and Dragons. And it was a light bulb moment for me because all of a sudden I wasn't constricted by this, square board with pieces on it. I was able to just unleash my imagination at this point. Mm-hmm. And I began pulling from all the TV shows and films that I loved. And it was probably one of the most rapid transitions from player to dungeon master in the history of gaming. It's like, I think I played once and I was like, no. This player's,
let me do this.
Yeah. Forget this stuff. Yeah.
By the end of the first session, you've taken over the DM screen.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, give me that book, man. You don't know what you're doing. Give me that book.
Yeah, yeah. Wait. Move over. You go sit there. I'm starting to think that might be like an only child thing. Because I feel like I had a very similar progression of like, oh, this was a lot of fun. Okay, let me do it now.
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So then it was a quick progression, I think, for me into both more RPGs, but then also more involved tabletop games. I got really involved in things like Axis and Allies, and that just, of course, pulled me deeper into the nerd crowd. And I think I went through a fairly, for my age, a fairly classic progression of nerdery through all of the RPGs that came out over the years. First, all the stuff from TSR, and then later into stuff like Vampire the Masquerade and Cyberpunk 2020. Mm. Both of those games, I think, for me, were watershed moments in how I viewed role-playing games, because they took a lot of the tactical combat out. And I mean, so certainly still there, right? But they put story forward. And I think that was the moment where I went, oh, there's a connection here for me. I've always been more interested in the story and the emotional beats of what's going on in my RPGs. And I've always been trying to push those mechanics, those dice mechanics, into the story. And I was going about it the wrong way. So I think that was my progression to the 90s. In the early 2000s, I think when D&D hit fourth edition, I sort of lost interest, partially because I was playing a lot of World of Warcraft with my friends. But then also because we had that sort of renaissance in tabletop gaming, I started getting into things like Catan and Ticket to Ride and all the other sort of newer European board games that were coming out. At that point, I'd gotten a film and television degree, and I was working in the studio system, and it was absolutely soul-sucking. There was nothing that drained my creative juices more than working for Hollywood. I was living in New Orleans at the time and working a lot of film crews out of New Orleans, and it was just a grind. And so after Hurricane Katrina, I sort of had to evacuate from Hurricane Katrina and ended up back in LA, which made it even worse, right? Like, there's nothing more of a grind than working in film industry in LA.
Sure.
Can you describe a little bit for folks just like a couple elements of that grind?
Absolutely.
Because most people haven't been in that kind of an environment.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think, a lot of people have a very sort of glamorous view of what it's like to come on to a set and that's quite possibly true for some of the more like A-tier actors. But as an example, I worked on a film called Failure to Launch, an old McConaughey film. You remember that one? Yeah.
Yeah. Pre-McConaissance.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Yeah. So I was on the crew for that. That was filmed almost entirely in New Orleans. There was some stuff that wasn't shot there, but for everything that was filmed in New Orleans, I was on that crew. And there was a shot at a scene at a baseball stadium. And it was supposed to be like a night baseball game. And the requirements for that shoot were such that we had to set up film gear in the stands the night before. And because of the nature of the shot and where the cameras had to be placed, where there had to be platforms, we literally worked, I think, about a 28-hour shift through the summer in New Orleans.
Oh, yikes.
In a rural area with mosquitoes.
Oh, no.
It was hot and humid, and we were covered in bug bites. And the stadium, of course, shut down their external lighting on a timer, which meant that we had to set up the film lights that we normally use for filming in order to finish setting up. So there was setting up all the lighting gear and everything else. I was per hour, I was paid a decent wage. But for a 26, 28-hour shift, that was not a lot of fun.
Yeah. That's really testing the limits of the, I do this for the love of it.
Yes,
you know
absolutely.
What I mean? Really, like,
absolutely.
At 25 hours, you're going, wait a second, I don't know if I love this anymore.
And I don't have anything against Failure to Launch. But like, my gosh, mm-hmm. that film is not one that I've rewatched since.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I can't imagine that you even could, honestly. No. Like, I feel like no. you'd be getting PTSD just yeah. thinking, like, oh my God, like thinking back to that night. In the
yeah.
stadium,
they don't call them a reconnaissance for nothing. There exactly. was most of the yeah. jewels of that dude's filmography are in the last 10 years.
Yes. When he leaned in his McConaugheyness. Yeah. He leaned
exactly.
into it.
Yeah. 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 He hadn't found his McConaugheyness yet.
But yeah, so I ended up in Seattle. I decided I needed to get out of LA and it was, again, sort of soul sucking. I was working in marketing and I wasn't really necessarily finding anything that was great. And then I ended up taking a job manning a retail game shop. It was a very left-hand turn for me. That was a relief to my soul because all of a sudden I was surrounded by people who loved a lot of the same things that I did. I found myself completely creatively re-inspired. Somebody who was a customer there scouted me to work for a distribution company called PSI. And PSI is sort of in a weird spot. They're a distributor for board games, but they exist in this kind of shadow world behind the scenes that the public doesn't really see. I mean, it's not nefarious in any way, but it's their primary customers are folks like Target and Walmart and Barnes & Noble. And then the other board game distributors, they distribute to distributors. And then their vendors are all of these game manufacturers, everybody from little indie folks like Smirk and Dagger. And there's a lot of RPG folks work with them. So they're sort of behind the scenes on a customer basis. You're not really going to see them. But it allowed me to see the sort of nuts and bolts of the board game industry in a way that I never had. And that's when I realized that it wasn't just when it came to representation and specifically native representation in games, it wasn't just that I, from a customer perspective, I wasn't seeing a representation. It was then me seeing how publishers approached the representation they did do. And I won't name names, but there were a couple of games that came out around 2016, 2017 that I saw. And I actually asked them, how did you get this native theme on the game? Who helped you with this? And honestly, one of the answers was, oh, one of our Italian designers is a huge fan of Native Americans. And I said, wait, what? Like, you don't even have an indigenous consultant afterwards to rubber stamp the game? Like, the absolute bare minimum for representation? And yeah.
It's remarkable. How often people who are like quote unquote fans of a culture will have a number of misinterpretations of still living cultures.
Yes.
And then their ideas will be interpreted and put into works. And it's like, wait, but the real people exist. We could actually, especially for larger projects that have budget, we could, or if it's just like a very accessible group of people, they're everywhere. Just go ask one of them.
I remember very specifically getting asked by an executive once, like, oh, like Jasper, you're like a big fan of anime. Maybe you should like lead this. And I was like, No. Like that's like, and all, like, first of all, this like anime that we're proposing is not set in England. It is set in Japan.
Yeah.
So maybe, you know, and like, it was, so like, yeah, that was a very fun conversation. Cause there's definitely a part of you that goes, oh, this is a big opportunity or whatever. And then you immediately have to slam on the brakes and be like, whoa, no, I really shouldn't do that. I really shouldn't be.
I think in both Europe and in North America, I think white people being in charge has become such a default. And this is not like a direct slam on any particular white person. I think it's just the embedded culture that they just have an assumption, a built-in assumption. I can do this because I'm a creative person in a position of power. I'll take that. Mm. And it's not even questioned. It's just an assumption.
Absolutely.
And I think at that point, when I saw that, I think that was the point at which I said, why am I not contributing? Why? It's one thing for me to criticize other people's works, but if I'm in a position where I can contribute, And here's where I have to really acknowledge the privilege that I had going into Coyote and Crow. A, I'm white passing. B, I'm in the industry and I know all of the distributors and publishers. I know the ins and outs of the industry in a way that most game designers just coming into the field probably don't. I'm in a position where I had a stable income and I fronted out of my own savings a lot of the money to get Coyote and Crow to where it was to be able to launch. And I wasn't going to go bankrupt if it didn't fail. I know a number of publishers who every time they launch a Kickstarter, it's do or die for them. And I don't know how they live that way, because the stress even that I was just under this personal project, when I hear, I know a publisher that actually put a mortgage on their house to get a game done.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, goodness gracious.
And that's not a sustainable environment for folks.
No, and I think that also as well is something that through no fault of these people, obviously, but it's like, that's like a deathbed for creativity. Yeah. You know what I mean? If you've got like that much riding on something, you know what I mean? Like that's like, you need to be in like a very easy, free place where you can, do you know what I mean? Where you can create these things and it's enjoyable. Like that's where the best work will come. And the idea of doing it under such enormous pressure is, terrifying.
Like literally life or death to an extent.
Yeah,
like your whole life will change if this fails.
Yes. And I was so fortunate that my life did change because of Coyote and Crow, but it can in the complete sort of opposite direction. I mean, I was just talking to somebody about this the other day, that there was a point at which Coyote and Crow's success stopped being about the RPG. It was about 2 weeks into the success, and I had a very big decision to make. And that was, do I just fulfill these backers and walk away? I had a full-time job. I had everything else I needed. Do I just fulfill this book and walk away from it? Or is this a moment where I change what I'm doing? And I felt an enormous amount of weight to that decision, that I think the idea was is I've gotten up a rung on the ladder. Do I just step off the ladder? Or do I help the person down below me on the next rung? And I'd like to say it was entirely altruistic, but I also know that there were a lot of, I think, native creators that I was already working with, writers and artists and all these other folks that had helped me get to Coyote and Crow where it was, that I think would have given me some shit. Sorry for the cursing.
No, it's absolutely fine. Go for it.
So then, they would have given me a lot of shit for not helping them up the ladder a little bit, and rightfully so, right? So I think at that point, about halfway through the Kickstarters, when I spoke to my bosses at the distribution company, PSI, and I said, I think this might have to be the end of my time with you. I think I have an obligation here to not just fulfill Coyote and Crow, but start a company with this and provide some positive examples for representation out there. And hopefully I'm doing
this. I can say that from the outside, it certainly seems that way. And like, I think one of the things that is so fascinating, it goes back to something we've talked about a lot, which is like just this overwhelming sense of pressure that is put on, you know, anyone who is trying to do something new or bring, you know, new people into the space. Like there is so much pressure that comes with that. The pressure of not failing, the pressure of not letting other people down, you know, kind of goes back to what we were just saying as well. The idea of like, you know, doing these things under a certain level of pressure rather than having, you know, the freedom to just be like, hey, I can mess this up and it's okay. You know what I mean? Like, whereas I think that the success of that Kickstarter is just beyond, you know, I should imagine it was probably beyond even your wildest dreams.
Far beyond.
And I'd love to ask you about that. But like, just in fact, actually, I guess I will ask you about that. Like, you know, how was that for you? That, you know, because I mean, it was, I mean, the figures are staggering.
Yeah,
right?
I think we set the goal at 18,000. Like, and 18,000, frankly, that was still going to be a bit of a loss for me. But it was a loss I was willing to stomach and just go, hey, this is going to get me enough to make my print run, satisfy my backers, and I'll have a product that I'm proud of. That was my starting point, right? And then 25, I think, was about where I was going to break even, 25,000 of what I'd put in. And I was like, cool, I can live with that too. That's great. And we hit that. I don't remember. It was maybe an hour and a half we hit that. And and then I think by the end of day two or three, we'd passed $100,000. And at that point, the panic started to set in.
I was going to ask what point you started to go, oh, no.
When did you run out of stretch money. Goals? Like, when did you have to start throwing more in?
So we had sketched out some stretch goals. Heather O'Neill, who works for Ninth Level Games, was my Kickstarter manager. And she's amazing, by the way, if you ever get a chance to speak with her. She does great stuff in the RPG world. And she has a lot of experience in Kickstarters. We had sort of sketched out some stretch goals early, but we'd blown through them so fast that by the time we got into the hundreds of thousands of dollars, we were scrambling for goals that made sense and trying to scale them appropriately. Cause we're like, how big is this going to be? We can't tell anymore.
The idea, I would love to have been inside your mind when you realized that you were going to have to come up with a $1 million stretch goal.
Oh my God.
I can't even imagine what is going on inside of my head during that moment.
I can give you a good picture. I can give you a really good picture.
Okay, awesome.
Imagine 12 raccoons fighting over a bag of trash. That's what was going on in my brain.
That's incredible. I mean, yeah, obviously, is absolutely phenomenal. And I think that one thing that is so awesome about it is that it really feels like, in a way that I think we were very kind of fortunate with, especially like just around the timing, there was such a desire in, you know, that kind of 2020 to end of 2021, 2022. I mean, still now to some extent, you know, there was just this huge thirst for anything that wasn't, you know, your traditional, European fantasy, you know, and I just think like it was such a beautiful, like vibrant time to see all of these works coming together and see all these people from different backgrounds suddenly feeling emboldened to create stuff and all kind of feeding off of each other. I think that when we see projects like this, you know, going to that extent, it definitely feels like a driving force for us to carry on doing what we're doing, because it's that kind of confirmation of like, oh, we're still doing something, and it's like, you know, that's of worth, and people are investing in and interested in.
I think a great example of that was the Nebula Award nominations that year. Up until that point, it had been always video games for game writing, and the fact that three tabletop role playing games were nominated that year. Huge swing, right? It was a massive swing. And I think that was a good indicator of the sort of tonal change in the industry, which is great. Like I still see a lot of RPGs coming out now that aren't Eurocentric fantasy, which is fantastic. Good on him.
Yeah.
I wanted to throw out, even as an American, especially, I feel like in America, Native Americans as a category of people are sort of like they exist in the past for most Americans, because because of essentially what has happened, you see Native Americans in movies. A lot of times it's not even actual Native Americans, it's other people playing Native Americans. It's so rare that you actually that you see a person who is Native American in a prominent position or like having an opportunity to actually depict their own culture. Like I remember seeing Smoke Signals years ago.
Oh my God.
And that movie,
classic.
Yeah, that movie's great. For those of you who don't know, I think at the time, I don't know if it still is, but at the time, I think it was the only movie that had an entirely Native American cast and crew, I think.
That sounds right. Yeah. I actually never looked up that statistic. That sounds right. Yeah.
Yeah. That movie's great. Absolutely. Go check that movie out. But it was so fascinating to get to see we get to actually see the people understand
natives as real people, not as caricatures or stand-ins, but real people.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And so to have this now in TTRPG, such a prominent and successful game and such a great game. I've only played little bit of it, but the little bit that I played, I was like, this is fantastic. I would absolutely play more of this. I think it's really it's really wonderful to see.
Thank you.
It is an unequivocal good, I think, for the TTRPG industry. I actually wanted to ask on that note, what about what were your inspirations for the lore and premise of the game? Now, I understand that the premise is that it's like it's essentially like sci-fi if Europeans never colonized the Americas. Yeah. But can you go into a bit more detail about the general lore and premise inspirations?
For sure. So I feel like the launching point for me was what I didn't want. And it was based on my reaction to a video game that came out at the time called Greedfall. And I don't know if you guys remember that one, but the brief premise here was that there is sort of a Victorian era Europe that has a plague or something like that, and they need to go to this savage land and find the cure from the mysticals who have magic. And it was painful to watch, right? I already knew I wanted to develop a game. It wasn't necessarily going to be an RPG at that point. It might have been a very complex board game, but I knew that the more lore I began to build out for it, the more I realized, this needs to be an RPG if I'm going to put this many pages of lore in it. And the more I tried to work around colonialism, because at the root, what I wanted was a game that didn't force natives to read through a chapter on the book of how did we deal with colonialism and have them revisit their own traumas I don't want to re-traumatize anyone. So the more I tried to come up with an idea for how did natives in this world deal with colonialism, the more I realized I just need a game that doesn't have colonialism in it. And so I forced myself into a corner of, I need an alternate timeline where colonialism didn't happen. And so that was the impetus for everything. Everything started from that point. But I think a lot of the other inspirations I had were, from films like films and comics like Black Panther, where you have a society that has, by some standards, is a utopia, but by anybody who closely examines it, is not a utopia. I mean, we get criticized in Coyote and Crow for saying, oh, it's a utopia because everybody has food, clothing, shelter, and education. I'm like, I'm sorry, folks. If your standard for utopia is the basic minimums for decent life, you're way out of whack. Capitalism and colonialism have done a number on you.
Yeah, that's rough.
Yeah.
It's a low bar.
It's a very low bar. So Wakanda obviously was an inspiration, but I also think the blending of nature and science that I saw in games like Horizon Zero Dawn were also a big inspiration. I love how they integrate those two things in that game. So those, I think, were sort of the inspirations. But really quickly, I think I developed this concept of the Adonati in the game, this mark, because I love when you get that gray area between science and magic. And a lot of settings feel like they need to define those two things, and I am absolutely against it. Obviously, in those settings, it's fine. Like Cyberpunk or Shadowrun or whatever have their very specific definitions of science and magic. But I think for my own native heritage, I like it when I can't put something into a box and I let other people decide what it is, which is why I never call out whether something is magical or mystical or science-based in Coyote and Crow. Sure. Just let my players decide. Let them build their own worlds out. But with the Adonati, I sort of had this MacGuffin that I could use, right, to sort of go, hey, we've got something that altered the world, that changed the way people interact with the world. It allows for a certain level of super science. I mean, there's hovering vehicles and sort of anti-gravity stuff, technology in the game that's powered by this Adonati. And then the Adonati also gives people sort of a special ability, not sort of superhero level abilities, but not enough to make their characters feel like standout heroes, which is really what I want, you know, for the game is for these characters to feel like they are characters who will be talked about around a campfire 100 years from now. Their stories are told, right? So they're supposed to be epic characters. So that was kind of the genesis for the setting.
This HeadGum podcast is brought to you by Aura Frames.
That is right.
From grandmothers to new mothers, aunts, even the friends of your life, every mom loves an Aura Frame.
Holy shit, even aunts?
Yes, especially aunts.
Oh, well.
Because it was named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter and selected as one of Oprah's favorite things. I mean, these Aura Frames are guaranteed to bring joy to moms of all ages.
I believe it.
You have an Aura Frame, don't you?
Yes, I actually more than believe it. I know it. I've got one for my mom, my mother-in-law, my grandmother-in-law.
And dare I say, your aunt?
And dare you say, my aunt and my aunt-in-law. Everyone's got one. Everyone loves them.
I mean, Mother's Day is right around the corner, and there's no better gift than a digital photo frame. You give them the frame. It's got preloaded pictures in there. And you know what? You can update it with an app. So every time you take a new picture of a sweet little person or place or thing in your life, it gets automatically sent to that frame.
Exactly.
And right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. Holy smokes.
Excellent deal.
Yeah, that's AuraFrames.com. You use the code HEADGUM at checkout to save.
HEADGUM. Nice.
Yes. HeadGum. It's easy to set up. It's loved by everybody, including Oprah, including your aunt.
Mm-hmm.
So do check them out. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code HeadGum at checkout to save.
Damn right.
And terms and conditions apply, of course.
Of course.
Thanks again to Aura.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Yeah, I think there's a couple things in there which really jump out to me. And one of them, I think, is that, you know, okay. I think it's a very kind of post-colonial, like, Western view of the world to be like, we have to label and understand everything and boil it down and take it apart, yeah. put it back together. And you know what I mean? Yeah. I think if you go to the roots of nearly any native culture who will have, you know, and you can go back and into, like, ancient parts of Africa and who had, you know, very advanced sort of for the time technologies, it wasn't necessarily a case of, like, having to sort of dissect every single thing and label every single thing. It was like there was an acceptance of the way that certain things worked, and I think that, like, that it's really interesting that you brought up Horizon Zero Dawn, because I remember feeling like a very strong connection to that game, just the idea of this kind of symbiosis between kind of, you know, almost like these three, like, you know, like magic, kind of the mystical, and then the kind of technology.
Yeah,
and I thought it was such a I think for a lot of people, honestly, a lot of people who have any kind of ties to anything like this, I think it did ring really true, actually. And I think it's a really kind of, like, interesting and, like, fun like idea and concept to kind of build this game out from, and I really, really enjoy that. How did the process, just to get sort of, like, mm-hmm. a little bit more technical sure. about the creation of the game, how did the process of, like, getting everyone together, I guess, especially mm. once, you know, this, it has then gone to another level, you know,
yeah.
you're the 18,000 you were hoping for turns into over a million,
yeah.
you know, what, just on a technical level, you know, what is that like in terms of, you know, the couple weeks afterwards when you're kind of, you know, now looking at the project in terms of the scope of it, what you want to achieve, the people that you want to bring on board, and I guess also, how did you go about finding those people? Because that's something yeah. that often gets yeah. thrown around as an excuse when not hiring, you know, the right people for the job. It's like, oh, but they're not out there, or, you know, they don't have the same level of experience right. or whatever. So I'm just intrigued yeah, as to how you found that process.
It's daunting. I knew from probably a third of the way into my development that, you know, once I had sort of the skeleton of the game and the skeleton of the mechanics that I wanted to use, that my own specific Cherokee background as a Cherokee citizen was actually to somewhat of a hindrance, in that if I make this game that covers all of North America and I don't cover all of the specifics of every real world nation in this place, but then I make it as a Cherokee citizen, I've sort of squashed their voices. And so I knew that while the game needed to be sort of an open sandbox for real world natives to be able to play in and add their own cultures to it, I also kind of knew that if I did it just on my own, everybody who was native was going to look at me and go, "Yeah, this is a thinly skinned Cherokee game. You've got a lot of Cherokee, you know, slant here, right?"
Sure.
So yeah. I think from that point, I knew that I had to bring other writers on board, mm-hmm. not just for a level of authenticity for the game, but because I think more writers makes an RPG better. I think you get different yeah. perspectives and ideas, and your world becomes more lived in the more voices you have. Mm-hmm. So getting the writers was actually pretty easy. I just sort of put some feelers out. I already had a decent social media presence, so I put some feelers out and asked around, you know, who had, you know, writing experience. And a lot of the folks who ended up writing for Coyote and Crow had never written for an RPG before. They'd written for other things. So that it wasn't too difficult to sort of handhold them through writing for an RPG process. That was pretty straightforward. But art was a completely different story. I think if you look on the Kickstarter, it still says, I think on the Kickstarter, because you can't change it once it closes. I think it still says a 300 page book. The final book is 471 pages, which is due to the fact that as we scaled up on the Kickstarter, we realized, oh, we need to provide more. We need to deliver more than that 300 page book. And that meant more art. And I was already working with a couple of Native artists, but I think the key dynamic, and I think you see this with a lot of marginalized circles of folks in any kind of creative endeavor, is that you have the few folks who are professionals. And those folks were very happy to work on Coyote and Crow, but they had a ridiculously limited schedule. I had one guy, an artist who works for Marvel Comics. He was like, I can give you two pieces of art in 18 months from now. And yeah, and that's not a timeline I can work with. I was very happy that he was willing to work with me on my budget, but that's not a timeline I can work on, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then on the other hand, I had artists who had never professionally published and who had no professional skills set at all to pull from whatsoever. They were always missing guidelines. They didn't know how to the technical formats to deliver the art in. And so as a not just a game designer, but also a project manager at that point, it becomes a lot of hand-holding and pushing and pulling. And you don't want to burn bridges or upset people, but you're trying to pull the best art out of them. And quite frankly, that's the biggest struggle I've ever gone through on this project, was getting the art to where I wanted it to be with the people I wanted it, wanted on board. And you know, even now, like I'm super thankful that I've got probably half a dozen Indigenous artists that I work with regularly who I love, and they are in touch with the futurism that I want. And that's another aspect, is that a lot of Native artists are working on keeping their own cultures alive. So they're often looking backwards. They're pulling from tradition, and which is great, but it also means that they aren't necessarily looking forward for futurism. And that can be tough to pull out of somebody. They will revert.
That's really interesting, actually. I never really kind of thought of that concept, the idea that, you know, with so many of these cultures that are either, you know, being slowly eroded away because of the way that, you know, we're kind of evolving as a society, that there is probably, you know, we do have a lot of focus on preservation and of keeping, you know, all of these things kind of safe and close to our chests. But actually, you know, maybe what we're not doing versus, you know, other people that constantly are, you know, as we've seen, because there's been, you know, we've been making sci-fi for so many years, you know, there isn't that sense of looking forward and like the idea of what that, you know, what this society, what this culture, you know, would look like, or does, how does that evolve? And I actually think that's a really interesting, that's a really, really interesting point, actually. I think there's a lot of, there's a lot of fruit to think of. There's a lot of things to think about in that.
I think, and I'd like to add that, like, I think one of the things that is also a personal thing for me is that in games, it's one thing to have accurate representation, to be like historically accurate when it comes to colors or ceremonies or traditions or whatever it is you're portraying in your game. It's one thing to be accurate, but there's still a perspective that you're giving. And I think that most games right now, the perspective when it comes to Indigenous folks, especially if it's not being produced by an Indigenous person, is it's a thing of the past. It's always a thing of the past, and it's usually them interacting with colonialist elements. They're interacting in the Revolutionary War or colonization. That's just traumatic at its foundational level for Indigenous folks sometimes.
Can you give us a little bit of understanding about the system for anyone who hasn't played the game, a little bit of understanding about the system? And also beyond that, what is the game about from a gameplay perspective? Like in the same way that you could say D&D is a power fantasy about fighting monsters, gaining prestige, saving the world. Like that's the end goal. Or as you mentioned, a lot of the other games started to play where it comes to like Cyberpunk and Vampire the Masquerade, the focus starts to be more on the story rather on, you know,
Absolutely. And I think for folks who aren't fluent with Coyote and Crow, the best sort of analogy I can come up with for the kinds of stories that we want to tell, I think can be encapsulated in what I think a lot of the best of shows like Star Trek do, which is introduce characters who are an established either literal family or chosen family, and put them in scenarios where they are encountering something new or something unexpected. I mean, it's not always new. Sometimes it's just the Romulans and the Klingons, right? So, but a situation that is new, that requires you to think about things in maybe a new way. Sometimes it ends up in a fight, and sometimes it doesn't. And sometimes you're trying to avoid the fight. And, you know, there's all that sort of feeling. But at the end, hopefully, you're coming away with a better understanding. And I think that's at the heart of a lot of Indigenous storytelling, whether they're violent stories or not, is you're trying to encapsulate the nature of the world a little bit in a story. I think I mentioned earlier that like for the characters, they're supposed to be building these epic heroes. And one of the things that we have in our experience mechanic, we call it the legendary system, is that you as a player are supposed to write down in a format what your character did to achieve that legendary level. It's sort of like leveling. So like when you level to a legendary one rank, you would write in a story format what your character did. And it's not supposed to be a literal accounting. Mm. It's supposed to be like an epic poem or a short story or a song or whatever you want it to be. And everybody, all the players at the table, do that on their own with their character as the center of that story. They're the hero in their own story. And then you reshare those stories and you come back and you realize, wow, I didn't remember that happening that way. I thought it was happened my way. You know, so you end up with these slightly, you know, slight variations on the story. But my mechanics hopefully reflect that. And that is that I use a D12 dice pool system that is meant to very much keep the game flowing. If the game is flowing the way I want it flowing, nobody has their books open. You've got your character sheet in front of you. You're telling the story. Anytime you want to be making a check to do something, whether it's combat or non-combat, you're rolling a pool of dice that are related to your stat. It's always D12s. And basically the foundation of it is you pick a success number. The story guide picks a success number, and that could be like, let's say 9, on a scale of 1 to 12. So then you're going to roll your dice pool, and every D12 that you get that scores a 9 or higher is a success. And sometimes a success is a binary. You either succeed or you fail. But oftentimes it's a number of successes that are needed. So you might need 3 or 4 successes to get something done. Right. And there's a bit of an explosive dice element as well. There's a way to roll a critical. If you roll a 12, you get to roll extra dice. But the idea is to add a sort of epic feel to the game, to your storytelling. I try to minimize the amount of dice rolling I do in the game. Certainly you can add crunch. You can add a lot of crunch to the game. If you're the kind of folks that want to be rolling dice all the time, go for it. I don't want to stop that. But hopefully my dice system facilitates the storytelling and doesn't slow it down.
Yeah, I think it really goes back to something that you mentioned earlier, which I think really comes across in the way that you describe the game and obviously what you've managed to create. And I think it's so wonderful, which is that you kind of very specifically said that, you know, the key in for you with all of this wasn't the kind of crunch, wasn't the maths or whatever. It was that emotional, you know, finding that emotional moment that where you emotionally connected to a character. And I think that it kind of clearly shows by the way that you know, you're talking about the game and the game that you wanted to make, that you're trying to kind of give other people that same experience. You want them to be, you know, heads up with their, you know, with their friends around the table, you know, really creating those stories together and hopefully getting to a point where they feel like they can emotionally invest. And I think that's really, really awesome. And I definitely feel like, you know, we've been lucky enough to kind of dip into loads more sort of TTRPGs recently. I think the space generally is diversifying, which is fantastic. And there really are, like, you know, so many other games that just are, like, really beautiful in that way that I was lucky enough to play some Kids on Bikes the other day. And I remember just like fully forgetting I had dice for about an hour. I was just like, oh, right. Yeah.
I'm so glad you brought up Kids on Bikes.
I'll roll this. I guess
that's a great game. You guys had Doug Lewandowski on the show?
No,
creator of Kids on Bikes. Oh, you should absolutely get him. He's amazing. So I called Doug a friend, and he is an amazing man. I love him.
Definitely,
give us his info because
we'd love to have.
We did a whole mini series, Kids on Bikes, earlier this year. Big Trouble in Little Manus.
Yeah,
it was a blast.
It was very fun. It was very, very fun.
Yeah, I will absolutely make an intro.
Amazing. Yeah, yes, please. Thank you I'd so love much. To. That's awesome. Well, I guess just to move on a little bit, you just had a new Kickstarter and another huge success again.
Thank you. Thank you.
Congratulations. Yeah. So I'd love to just sort of, you know, what do you think, what are you hoping that the Wolves expansion is going to bring to players who, maybe some players who are familiar with Coyote and Crow, and maybe other players who are new, and, you know, what are you hoping for that they'll get out of the new expansion?
So the game is technically set in the world of Coyote and Crow in its past. So you're playing as an agrarian leader of a community. It's a classic tabletop board game, but it is technically standalone. You don't need to have any knowledge of Coyote and Crow to play it. Mm. one of the things that concern me with getting into TTRPGs is that there can be a high barrier to entry, both in terms of cost sometimes, but then also, especially if I'm putting out a 400-page book, mm-hmm. But then also the sort of intimidation factor for folks who are not used to TTRPGs and the rule set that comes along with it. It can be a scary thing if you don't have somebody, like the right person, to introduce you to a role-playing game. So board games for me are my attempt to reach out to a wider native audience. If non-natives play my games, that's great. I love that. That's wonderful. But I'm trying to speak to an indigenous audience because I think so often I see that they're still, A, they don't have as much disposable income, but then B, oftentimes their game shelves are full of things like Monopoly. And that's like the last thing I want to see on a native person's shelf, right? So
there's so many layers to that. It was just like, as you were saying that, I was just processing like, oh my God, yeah, no. Oh, fuck, please, yeah. No.
Yeah. No. Absolutely. Absolutely. So I'm trying really hard to expand into board games as a sort of a baby steps, right? So it's a baby steps to bring them into modern board gaming, into modern game ideas of community around gaming. And maybe they'll get to the RPG eventually, or maybe it's not the cup of tea. That's fine too. But I want to keep providing board games that can engage native audiences in a way that are as hopeful and accurate, and just bring sort of that modern aesthetic to an indigenous audience. So the game incorporates ideas of a gifting economy. Are you guys familiar with gifting economies?
Could you explain?
At all?
Because even if I'm familiar, which I'm not sure I am.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I would have anyway, just for the audience, right? So gifting economies are common in a lot of indigenous cultures. You see a lot of it happen in the Pacific Northwest, but globally, there's a lot of this. And that is that if you're in a group who's producing something and producing product A, and then you've got a group over there that's producing product B, and you both need A and B, then at a certain point, if you're producing more than you need, you take that excess and you just go over to the other group and go, here you go, take A. There's no barter. There's no buying. There's no economy there. You are just giving them that. And maybe you've already got enough of product B that the other person doesn't need to give you any. In that case, they don't. There's no exchange there that's a direct currency or a physical exchange. Now, there is sometimes the sort of idea of status or bragging rights. There's the idea that you can go, hey, I'm such a good fisherman that I can provide for my own people and I can provide for you. But that's more bragging rights toward your own people because you're going, look, I can take care of those people over there too on top of us. And that makes you look like a good leader. It makes you look like you've got an organized society. It's bragging rights, right? So in the game, Wolves, you're all playing these leaders of these communities that need to survive through winter through sharing of resources. And you can maybe make it on your own, but if any player fails during the game, everybody loses the game, which encourages you to gift other people your excess resources. Now, at the end of the game, the person who is most effectively gifted their resources is elected chief of all the communities. So there is still an individual winner, but you've all got to make it across that finish line in order to get to that point.
Yeah.
And I think there's just a lot of, there's a lot of good messaging in there, I think. Personally, I think it's not something you see in a lot of board games.
I love the idea, like, hey, yeah, I have more stuff, and I'm gonna brag right now and tell you how cool I am and how great I am, but I'm gonna do it in a way that gives you a valuable resource that you need. You know what I mean? Like, that feels like the least toxic way that you could.
My
do
awesomeness
that.
Is
like,
for your benefit.
Yeah, exactly. I'm a big fan of that.
Yeah. I mean, natives are big show-offs. If you've ever gone to a powwow, you are going to see some people show off. Yeah. We love to brag.
It's like, I think there's I can think of a lot of similarities, especially like whenever I'd go over to my friends, and I've got one particular friend who lives in Croydon, and whenever I go to his house, his mom's like, sit down, I'm giving you the best meal of your life and you will love it. You know what I mean? But it's like, it's definitely like an aggressive thing, you know what I mean, for her. Like, she's very extremely passionate about this. It's not out of like an altruism. It's just like, no, I need to to show you that I can give you the best meal of your life.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's what's important to me.
You know what's cool about that too, is I've seen that cross-cultural, and I think the unifying behavior there is it's marginalized and or poor communities, because there's this idea of like, man, this resource is important to me, and I've gotten it to a point where I've perfected it. And now you all need to see like how we've thrived with as little as we've had.
Yeah.
And I love that.
Yeah.
Like, you go down to New Orleans, you get some of the best food. I mean, there's a million examples of this, right? Like peasant food is some of the best food on the world. Any culture's peasant food.
Yeah. I'm always just like, the more like kind of just like basic a stand looks, you know what I mean? Like a food stand. Yeah. You're like, yep. You know, whatever they're cooking is going to be straight fire. So, rather than going to like some fancy market and being like, oh, you have Jamaican food? Are you sure? Like, because I doesn't, you know what I mean? Or you look kind of white to me, so I don't know if this is going to.
I was just going
to
say, not exactly. An ounce of melanin in the whole restaurant. Oh, no. You know, you're in trouble,
absolutely
right?
Absolutely not. But there's the word jerk is everywhere.
Yeah,
for sure. Well, I just, Jeremy, I don't know if there's anything else that you wanted to throw out before we sort of start to wrap this up.
The only thing I will say is that we got to play this game on the show sometime. I cannot wait to do this because, I think it is an unequivocal good for the gaming industry as a whole. And things like this existing in especially American culture at large, I think can only help because of the lack of representation by Native Americans of their own culture, especially in such a cool futurist sort of context, which. Again, you so rarely see for a lot of different marginalized cultures. So this is really awesome.
And I really hope that like any success that, you know, Coyote and Crow has, maybe even to an extent that Three Black Halflings has, is proof to people that you don't need to make something which you think is going to be, you know, a mass appealing or whatever it is, you know, that people of all shapes and sizes will interact with your content if it's coming from a place of like honesty and truth, and you just want to make something cool. You know what I mean? And you wanted to make something cool for Native people. That was your focus. But what you ended up making was something that everyone the world over was like super excited about and wanted to play and wanted to, you know, get on board with. And I think it's a really important lesson that I think we're maybe starting to, like, you know, I think that a lot of people on our level are getting that, but I think, you know, there's like people sort of above us who maybe just need to understand now, like, hey, you can make something that is like really like, you know, if there's an earnestness and a truth to that creativity, you will, no matter how specific that thing is, people will want to interact with it, people will want to see it, people want to check it out, and I really hope that they use
be true
that.
To your audience. Absolutely.
100%. So just before we wrap this episode up, one thing that we always do with all of our guests is we ask them for a tale from the table. So this can be any kind of story, anything that jumps out you know, from your playing. You know, if you've got an example from Coyote and Crow, that would be amazing, but it can be any TTRPG that you've played, but just a moment. It can be like heartfelt and like lovely, it can be hilarious, it can be very silly, it just anything that jumps out to you. Tell us a little
story. So I've been wanting to share this one for a while. It happened a couple of weeks ago. Cool. And I was attending a small event in Tacoma, Washington, and it was on Indigenous Futurisms. And so we had like a vendor section, and there was music going on, and I was pretty much the only game vendor there. Everybody else was dealing in crafts or other things, you know, and sitting there at the table, and a family was working their craft table a couple of tables down, and they had brought their kids with them, and the kids quickly got bored, as kids do. There was a little boy around 9 and a little girl around 11, I think. And then they were sort of attracted to my table and came over and started asking me questions. About 20 minutes later, the little boy comes back and says, "How much is your book?" And I'd given him the spiel already, like the brief lowdown of what Coyote and Crow was. And I said, "You know, it's $70. And the little boy and the little girl started talking back and forth. And I could tell that they had seen or heard about D&D enough to know what role-playing games were. And the little boy comes back a few minutes later and he says, "I got a gift card for my grandma with $100 on it. Can I buy your book?" And I was so excited and flattered, but I was also like, I also know little kid purchases, right? And I didn't want him to regret it. And I was like, "Well, why don't you just take a copy of the book and look at it for a little while and make sure this is something you want to do. Maybe talk with your mom about it. Just make sure, right?" So he comes back about a half an hour later with the card. He's like, yeah, I want to buy the book. And he just launches at that point, like not even had bought the book yet. He launches in to the character he's going to make. He and the little girl have been reading already, and she's going to make a healer and he's going to make a warrior. And he says, you know, the warrior, he's got to have high spirit. You know, that's one of the stats in the game. He's got to have high spirit because a leader needs to have really high spirit. And I'm going to give him the ability of Ancestor Storm because that really will like help him be a good leader. Like he'd already read through the abilities.
Wow.
That's and so cool. he buys the book, and I was like, take a dice set, kid. So happy birthday, you know, it's his birthday money. So I gave him a set of dice. He came back a few minutes later and with the card, the remainder of the money on the card, and bought our story guide screen too, just because he loved the art on it. Mm. And I remember that feeling from when I was a kid first engaging in role-playing games and that sense of imagination. And I was like, that just made everything I did for Coyote and Crow worth it right there. That one interaction was enough to have sold me on it.
Yep.
Just the fire in that kid's eyes and how excited he was to play.
Absolutely.
That's cool.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
I can't ask for anything
better. Those are the moments, right? Those are absolutely the moments. You know, I can think of moments, I'm sure, Jeremy, you've had them as well, where you just go, okay, that's it. Like, we've done that. I'm happy. Like, I'm happy that, you know, like, even if we achieve nothing else, like, that was pretty awesome. Well, Connor, thank you so much for coming on the show. I can't tell you how much we appreciate you giving up your time. And I just wanted to, as well, just call out the absolute peak minority mindset that was going on when you said a 300 page book is not enough. Like, if there's anything that sums up, you know, being a minority in the creative space, that was a perfect moment where you said, no, 300 pages is not enough. We need more. But all I can say is thank you so much for, you know, for creating those 300 and more that you've made. And I want to echo exactly what Jeremy said, that it's a really fantastic thing for the space. So please tell all of the halflings listening at home who are now, I'm sure, are chomping at the bit to, you know, learn more about Coyote Crow and maybe get themselves a copy, etc. Where can they find you yourself, and then anything that you have either coming up or anything that's out right now that you want to shout out? The floor is yours.
We have our website is coyoteandcrow.net, just Coyote and Crow, all just spelled out. And all of our socials are listed there. We've got an amazing Discord group that's really active and fun to be with. We're on Twitter, Blue Sky, under Coyote and Crow Games. In fact, pretty much anywhere on the internet, if you just drop a Google search and say Coyote and Crow, the only other Coyote and Crow you're going to get is some weird New York folk band. I shouldn't say weird. They're fine. Yeah.
They're just very normal.
Not in any way connected to me. Yeah, like, they're fine. But pretty much easy to find. We're on Facebook as well, Coyote and Crow Games. On our website, we've got all the links to our web store. You can also find our games on Amazon and Amazon UK and Amazon Canada, and then through your local game stores, which is, I love it when folks can buy at local game stores if you can. I love supporting that economy.
That's definitely a big like bucket list item, to like have something in like an actual physical store. I think would be, you know, and to be supporting like an independent vendor like that, I think is really awesome. Connor, again, thank you so much for coming on. Halflings, if you're listening to this and you're intrigued by the game, please go and check out Coyote and Crow. Go and at least give them a follow and stuff on social media, and maybe check out the book. And then stay tuned, because we are certainly going to be playing some of this game on Through Black Halflings in the near future. And I'm very, very excited to do so. But before we go anywhere, Jeremy, where can people find you on the internet?
Okay, I'm going to try and make this way quicker than the last time.
good luck, my
here
dude.
Here we go.
Last time we went on for another 25 minutes.
Yes. Twitter and Instagram, Twitter, Blue Sky, Jeremy Cobb 1, Cobb with 2 P's, the number 1.
Good stuff.
You can find me on Instagram at the Cobbmeister. You can find me on the Quantum Reactor at Q Reactor Show on Twitter. You also can join our Discord. It is a science fiction movie review podcast. You can find our podcast wherever pods are cast. I also stream on Twitch at Casual Quest Live, twitch.tv/Casual Quest Live. Tuesdays we do Fallout New Vegas. We just started the old World Blues DLC, and then on Thursdays we do Deus Ex Human Revolution. Sundays, we do extra long Baldur's Gate 3 streams. And when we finish Old World Blues, we're going to switch Tuesdays as well to be Baldur's Gate 3. So it's just going to be Baldur's Gate is just going to be so wide open.
Hello, Baldur's Gate.
Yeah, you won't be able to walk anywhere for want of walking straight through it.
It's really too bad you don't have a scroll effect for that, because that's great. Yeah, I pictured on a giant scroll.
Absolutely. Yeah. Someone needs to animate that.
Two last things. On a stream I want to shout out on Roll For It called Lake Mirana. I just forgot the name of the show I was on. Playing Call of Cthulhu. It is on Thursdays, I think, at noon PST is when it streams. We just had episode one last week, and it was fantastic. My character is a sad man, so go check that out. And then finally, if you want to play with me, do it at D3 at Sea. I'm going to be at D3 at Sea this October into November, leaving, I believe, October 25th, but I can't remember the date. Regardless, go to D3atSea.com and sign up to play with me. That's it.
Whoa, thanks, Jeremy. A tight 15 minutes this time. Very well done.
Shaved 8 minutes off, baby. Eight minutes.
Let's go. I am Jess William Cartwright. You can find me at JW_Cartwright on all of my social medias, which is where I'll be announcing all of the new and cool stuff that I'm doing. And there is new and cool stuff. I know I've been saying that for about 6 months, but I promise there is actually stuff that I will be announcing eventually. You can also find me on Games and Feelings show, which I'm kind of a semi-regular co-host of the Performance Capture podcast. I'm on this season of Dark Dice, playing Ajay Ogun, and one of my favorite characters I've ever played. And last but not least, I think I can say this now because they don't seem to be particularly secretive about it, so it's absolutely fine, I guess. I'm going to be on Oxventure coming up, I think, in September as well, which is going to be really, really cool. We just recorded that, and I'm very excited to get to show you me being a gunslinger again. It felt like a little callback to Tobo, and that made me happy. This has been Three Black Halflings. You can find the show at 3, that's the number 3, Black Halflings on all of our social medias. Don't forget to check out our Patreon, which is where you get bonus episodes. You can listen to this episode completely ad-free. And there's a bunch of other content on there, including we do shout-outs, we do live streams, hangouts, all that kind of good stuff. So make sure you go check us out. But until next week, we will say so long, Shire Folk.
So long, Shire Folk.
You can say it too,
Connor. So long, Shire Folk.
Yes!
That was a HeadGum Podcast.